Access number 29536, Mr. Bert Scriven, Real 10. Now, what happened after you got to Enfeeville? The troops deployed into action, or moved forward straight away. What happened to you?
Well, we started, we lagered up, as we call it, and started to unload the battalion's stores and so on. Not ammunition, of course. And we were pottering around, and some distance upwind of me, one of the storemen decided for some unknown reason to black his cap badge, and he proposed to do that by heating it and dipping it in oil, burning it and repeating the process. To do that, to get the heat, he used one of our cut-off petrol cans, tipped up on one corner, into which he'd poured a quantity of methylated spirits. And he was happily doing that and ran out of methylated. So he took a 2-gallon can of methylated and poured it into the top corner of the petrol tin he was using, which was quite successful. And then he decided that he hadn't got quite enough methylated spirits, so he poured some more in. By which time, of course, the methylated spirits had crept up the tin and immediately set light to the 2-gallon can he was holding. I was some 10-15 yards downwind of him, and I thought to myself what an idiot he was doing that kind of thing. And then the wind blew, and I immediately looked down and found I was covered in little blue flames, and both knees, my face was scorched, I thought my hair was scorched, so I sort of dropped and rolled and put out the flames. Strangely enough, he was immediately, in fact, holding the 2-gallon can. He was above the whole thing, and he didn't get anything wrong with him. I got the lot. I thought I'd just been scorched, realised that I'd lost my eyebrows and eyelashes, and a moustache which I'd been trying vainly to grow for about 3 months. Didn't think much more about it, except I was scorched. As it happened, in my kit I had a jar of clear petroleum jelly. So I rubbed that over my scorch marks. Didn't think much more about it. Yelled at him and cursed him up and down a bit. And didn't think much more. Then I had a call to take a lorry load of ammunition forward to battalion headquarters. So I called up the driver and we got in the lorry and we went there. Everybody was trying to get in some sort of position. Battalion headquarters was trying to dig in and position themselves as they should. It was a bit chaotic at the moment. But my attention was called to the fact that we were immediately at the base of the hills, where apparently Germans were dug in at the very, almost the summit. The hill, I was told, was a razorback. In short, it went on a fairly even slope up from where we were to the top. But the back of it was concave in profile, and apparently the Germans had dug through and made sort of caves all the way through, tunnels and caves, and they were in there. as we watched, a skirmish line of Gurkhas was going up the hill. This is the only time I've ever seen them in action, or rather, didn't see them. They went up the hill in a really nice line, copybook stuff. Then a whistle blew, and they all disappeared. And then nothing happened for quite a few minutes. And then all hell broke loose on the top of the hills. We still didn't see anything, but I never did see the result of that, because I was called away to give some ammunition out to various people who wanted it. And having done that, I went back to the camp that I'd left previously. By that time, my arm, left arm, and both legs and my face was burning some, but I didn't pay too much attention to it. I thought, well, a scorch, it'll be all right. We ate, I bedded down, woke up in the morning, and found that I had hundreds of tiny blisters on my left forearm, and my knees were surrounded with big sausage-like blisters all the way around. And then I looked in the mirror and saw that I'd lost half my hair, my eyebrows, eyelashes, the moustache. And I decided that it was about time I went to a dressing station. And there was one along the road from us, so I called up the bloke who had caused the thing in the first place, told him to get my motorbike, and said, right, I'll ride on the pillion, because I can't ride it. You take me down to the dressing station, and I'll get them to do something about it, and you can bring me back again. Which, well, the first part we did. I went down to the dressing station, and immediately they sent him away and said, right, you're staying here. Didn't do anything about my face, so it was only scorched, I presumed. But for my legs, they snipped all the blisters, and then with a pair of tweezers, stripped, without any anaesthetic of any kind, stripped all the skin down to the live where it tore off. Of course, immediately the flesh under the dead skin was exposed. It hurt like hell, I must admit. However, it had to be done. Then they painted me with gentian violet and asked me what had happened. And I told them that petrol burning hydro cooker, which is a pressure cooker the cooks use, we've been testing it, and there was a blowback, and I'd caught it. Just an accident, no one was to blame. It's one of those things which they seem to accept. And then they sent me off to a bed, and I was to lay there with my legs stiff while the gentian violet, which I'd painted on, dried. Well, while it dried, I obviously at some time had bent my left leg, and when it dried, it formed an enormous violet-coloured scab on both legs. So I was left with one knee bent and one straight. And then they attended to my left arm. They, for the very first time, I'd never heard of it before, they used the sulfanilamide drug, powder, which they powdered all over my left forearm, and then wrapped me in a Vaseline gauze, and bandaged, and that was changed every day, and each time they did, there was a complete new skin on the Vaseline gorge. Beautiful stuff, I thought. Didn't cause me any pain. I mean, there was no pain in changing the dressings. The skin was brand new and just came off with the dirt. That happened for a number of days, and then they decided it was all right, and they left the dressing on while the skin grew in place and adhered. Meanwhile, I had to be mobile, especially if I wanted to get food and go to the latrines, which was across a small field. And I did a sort of dot and carry one all the way. And that was damn painful, I must admit. I was visited by the quartermaster, who was in charge of us all. And he asked me what had happened, and I told him the official story, which he accepted. And I just stayed there in the dressing station for about 3 weeks, I think. Meanwhile, apparently, the Germans had given up, or they were in the process of giving up. There were very few casualties, I understand.
So you were still in the NFP?
But I was still in the dressing station. After about 3 weeks, they told me that all right, I could return to duty, although they had asked me several times if I would go back to Army headquarters and hospital. But I thought that if I did that, I would probably be shifted to another unit that I didn't know, and I didn't particularly want that. And Lord knows what would have happened. Obviously, I'd have been transferred as a storeman to wherever, because records would eventually have found me and transferred me elsewhere. So I thought I'd rather deal with the devil I knew than the one I didn't, stayed and requested to return to my own unit.
And where were they when you rejoined them?
They were a little further forward than the dressing station was, but roughly the same area.
So still in
that
area.
Still in that area. They sent transport to take me there. And I had a bivouac to myself.
So this would be April, probably? Or still March?
Oh, this would be April, I think. Yes, it would be. And there I saw the result of the action, where hundreds, thousands probably, of German prisoners of war were going in a mob, almost, southward, well, backwards anyway, to base area for prisoner of war camp somewhere.
What state were they in, or what did they appear to be in?
They didn't seem too bad, very dejected, guarded by very few people, as usual, but then, where the hell would they go anyway? if they ran away, they've got nowhere to go. So there it was. They just went on back, and I just pottered around. I wasn't doing anything in particular. Just pottering around, waiting for my legs to get better and the scabs and so on to heal, so I could get mobile again. Spent a lot of time in my bivouac reading anything I could get hold of. And then, I don't know, I suppose it must have been after 2-3 weeks, we were given orders to move again, so we got back onto our lorries, and we moved back to an area outside Tripoli. We were in an almond grove, very close to a test road racing track, rather like Brooklands, except that it wasn't banked. And we bivouacked down there. It's an almond grove. There were vineyards close by, various fruit trees and so on. And there we had to, there we stayed. And at that stage, they started off the blood donor sessions. We were told about them. And out of sheer self-preservation, I decided to volunteer, which I did. We were told we were going to get half a pint of Guinness after each session, which didn't mature. We got a glass of local brew, which was ghastly stuff, but there it was. They used very, very thick rubber tubing to take the blood away, and a very thick a needle.
So it's quite painful.
Well, yes. The worst thing was that because it was a large diameter tube, comparatively, they took the blood very fast, and we were on stretchers on sort of hurdles, as it were. And of course, as soon as you sat up and swung your legs over the edge, all the blood was in your feet. And there were quite a large number of floppers, as we called them, people who just collapsed. Then we were given this glass of horrible brew and turned loose for the day in Tripoli. Had to return in the evening and back to your unit, as it were. We didn't do anything very much. We had a big anti-fly campaign where we had to... what we had to do was to get our main meal, which was usually melted corned beef mixed with raw onions that had been chopped up into a ghastly mess, and Indian-style biscuit. Now, the British Army biscuit was a savoury sort of thing. Thick, arrowroot type, I suppose, or what was later known as cream crackers and so on, a water biscuit, which wasn't bad because it was sort of neutral flavour. But the Indian Army biscuit was sweet, or sweeter, and it didn't go very well with melted corned beef and onion. It was a bit of a horrible mix, but that's the kind of food we were getting.
Before we go on the flight, what other food? Was that it?
That was the main meal.
What was the other food?
Biscuits again, jam, tinned herrings, nothing that was very appetising, I must say.
Any fresh vegetables, or other than these chopped onions?
The only ones I saw were the eggplant, and they were sliced and fried. Apart from that, very little.
Now, how were the flies a problem, and how did they...
Well, the flies, they swarmed everywhere. Didn't matter where you went, there were flies everywhere. Particularly if you were in a tent. There was office tents, of course. And you go in one of those and you've got flies in all places. Didn't help if you used a fly spray, because the damn things dropped dead all over you. Which was not at all pleasant. But the campaign was that To obtain a meal, you had to present 10 dead flies, which didn't make very much difference to anything. There are all sorts of different insects and small animals there we'd never seen before. I'd never seen again, come to that. There were hornets, other... I don't know whether they're animals or insects or whatever. Land crabs, we call them. But that was just our name.
Were they a nuisance?
The hornets were a bit. Otherwise, not too much. Oh, there were some rather enormous spiders as well. But we got on pretty well. Main thing is we were living in our little bivouacs, as it were. And we'd been without rain or anything for some months by then. And, of course, we hadn't dug trenches round to lead the rainwater off away from the tent. Until one day it rained. And at first, it was exactly like one would expect to see, and one has seen scenes like it in films. Everybody was standing outside, jumping up and down, and saying, "It's raining, it's raining." But within 10 minutes, we were all standing around there, heads down, hands in pockets, muttering around, "It's always bloody well raining, isn't it?" That's when I came to the conclusion that rain to the British is a state of mind rather than a climatic condition. And of course, all the contents of our tents, because the rain had run underneath, were wet. So we had to dry those out. But it's also where I learned that it was, if you wanted something cold, then you stood things in the sun so that the outside evaporated, as in the Indian Army Chuggle water carrier, which was a canvas bag which you filled with water and stood in the sun. The sun evaporated the water on the outside of the bag, made the inside cool. Unless you stood it too long, and then of course the inside started to get warm. I was lucky. I didn't get as thirsty as most people. In fact, I had no tolerance for water at all. And I quite often think to myself, I'd like a drink of cold water, so I'd pour one into my tin mug, take about 3 swallows, and that would satisfy me. I couldn't drink any more. And I found that right through my life since, strangely. Then we were shifted.
Were you doing anything in the, you know, outside Tripoli, or were you just waiting, really?
Well, we were sort of waiting, and we were going to go into training. It was, that would be obvious, but we didn't know what training. And it was at this time I was told positively that my responsibility from there on would be the battalion's ammunition.
So you'd only been doing that... Okay. Well, now, what did that all mean?
Well, that meant that I had to get ammunition to wherever it was required. Didn't matter how far forward, but I had to get it there. I had allocated to me the battalion's ammunition supply as laid down in regulations, and I had, I think, 3 lorries to move it to start with. In point of fact, I didn't do anything much about it because we weren't using any, and it was just stacked under canvas sheets, and that was that. I had to look at it every now and then and have a quick count up to make sure that we got our allocation. But apart from that, there were no duties. It was strange because, as far as I know, we were the only battalion who did it this way. I was a corporal on doing it. It was usually the job of the regimental sergeant major. But for some reason or other, the CO had decided that the sergeant major was required for other duties at battalion headquarters, so it got down to me. Didn't make much difference to me. I was just acting most of the time as a sort of infantryman in the headquarters company, guard, whatever. Then we went into training for land assault. In other words, we were going to go ashore somewhere.
What sort of training was that? What do you remember of that?
Well, we had to learn, first of all, how to swarm ashore from the sea without actually going to sea at that stage. Dig a slit trench in a hurry, get into it. Then on orders, you charge forward, etc., etc., on an assault. Then we were put into LCIs, landing craft infantry, and we tried that going ashore from them, splashing through the water. My main memory is that salt water and sand are a very sticky mix. It was most uncomfortable, and you couldn't wait to get a wash down afterwards. But it was the usual infantry stuff of doing as you were told when you were told to do it, doing a lot of digging and getting into slip trenches.
Would you be back with the ammunition in the headquarters company?
Ah, well, I presume I would be back with the ammunition, but I was doing the training. Then, somewhere around August, I was detailed to take a lorry down to a waterproofing depot. So the driver and myself threw our kit aboard, and we went down to this waterproofing depot where we stayed a couple of weeks, just in a lorry park, waiting for our turn for the lorry to be waterproofed. Eventually it was done. Most of the time we were just hanging around. I think most of your time in the army is spent doing that. Just hanging around, waiting for our turn. Eventually our lorry was taken. The engine was waterproof, the exhaust extended above the cab. And
just one of your three lorries, though.
This is one. I don't know what happened to the other two. And I presume somebody else took two more lorries, but I didn't see them. What happened then? Oh, yes. After that, I rejoined the unit, and it was decided that because we were going from Africa to presumably mainland Europe, light or damn near white by that time khaki drill would not be suitable. And our clothing had to be dyed. There was no dye available, so we were issued with a lot of coffee, which was stewed up, and then all our clothing had to be dyed in the coffee to ready for going ashore at least, because we were going in, obviously, in KD.
Did it work? Was coffee dye?
Oh, yeah, it did. The only unfortunate thing is that it was inclined to wash out as well, and it was damn sticky. It was the most uncomfortable experience. Then